KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The August primary is less than a month away, and ballots should start to arrive in mailboxes this week. We're going to be talking to all nine Seattle mayoral candidates on Weekday in the Conversation this week, and this morning, Kate Martin and Doug McQuaid will join us. Protests continued last night around the country. Participants denounced the jury decision to acquit George Zimmerman of second-degree murder charges in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. There were calls for justice, there were calls for a civil lawsuit, and more generally for dialogue about racism and its lingering impact in America. It's a conversation we'd like to help foster here, and to that end, Sakara Remu joins us. She's a writer, activist, and a self-described mother of black children. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to know first whether you took part in the demonstration Sunday evening at Westlake Park.
No, I didn't. I was there in spirit.
There's a sort of confusing series of reactions, I think, overall. Participants have been very, very angry, which is understandable. But there's some people that are calling for Justice Department action, some people who would like to see Trayvon Martin's family file a civil suit, and some people who are just more generally really talking about, let's talk about this. Do you, first of all, think that a conviction of George Zimmerman would have helped when we talk about anger over racism?
I do. I think that, you know, it's not about, I think anger is, I don't know if anger is necessarily the right word. There's so much that comes before that. But I think what a guilty verdict would have shown was that racism is more than lingering in this country. It's alive and well every day, and it's about perception and the power of perception was at the heart of this case. It was whether or not this child actually was a threat or was perceived to be a threat because of George Zimmerman's own internalized racism about what a black man or black boy represents in society.
How old are your children?
My son is 13. My daughter is 17, almost 18.
So you have a son who's almost the age that Trayvon Martin was when he was shot. What do you tell him about his experiences in the world or how he should move through the world?
Well, we have actually been having that conversation absent the Trayvon Martin case or decision because my son is a young black man and we live in South King County, which presents its own set of historical challenges around race. And he has had issues more than ever since beginning middle school about what other people perceive him to be and what other people perceive his behaviors to mean, absent of, you know, content of character, of course, just the visual perception and people's subconscious beliefs and stereotypes about race and young black men. And he has been asking me and saying things to me like, I want to be normal. I want to be able to have a normal life just like anybody else and do, you know, what my white friends do. And I tell him, you are normal. You're not white. And so that's the conversation that we're having now, just generally.
When did he start to become aware of those differences?
I think he's always been aware of the differences because he grows up, you know, in my house. And this is the work that I do. So he's used to hearing really in-depth conversations about race and power and privilege and perception. But I think in his own life, he has been racially profiled in elementary school, he was racially profiled and accused of breaking into somebody's car and had to negotiate police coming to his school to question and possibly arrest him for something that he hadn't done. So that was a wake-up call, I think, and made it really real for him, and he expressed that at that time. This was 2 years ago, that, you know, he hears it intellectually, and we have these conversations intellectually, but having gone through it gave it a greater significance in his own personal journey.
Yesterday, Attorney General Holder called for a conversation, a dialogue in America about race and racism. How do you envision that that could happen or would happen?
I think it's already happening. I mean, these are conversations that I have every day in my circles. I don't know what a national dialogue, a led dialogue around race would look like. I think we're so timid in this country about talking about race that people in positions of power are afraid to step out and say ABCD is racism. That's directly a result of the social construct of race. Instead, what happens in this country, we get into a conversation about intention versus the impact. And an example of that is one of the jurors of the Zimmerman trial, I think juror B37, gave an interview last night and was talking about George Zimmerman's intention, that she thought he had, his heart was in the right place. That says a lot of things. One, it says straight up jury nullification. Yeah. But also it shows that they focused on what they felt was Zimmerman's best intention to protect the neighborhood, to deal with, you know, an increase in vandalism. And they did not address his impact, which was that he killed somebody because he racially profiled them and started an altercation. That's really where I see the dialogue needs to go, because too often when the everyday person is having a conversation about race in the workplace, you know, if a person of color has been offended some way, often you will hear the offender, the white person, say, well, I'm sorry, that wasn't my intention. Well, that doesn't matter. We need to get beyond that safe space of I didn't mean to, I'm a good person, and get to, you can be a good person and still have a severely detrimental impact on other people based on their race and based on your race and your privilege.
Is there such a thing or such a path to an America that we don't see race, or that it's just not an issue anymore?
No, I don't think so. Race is, there is no such thing as post-racial America. We're never going to get to post-racial America, not in my lifetime, not in my children's lifetime, not so long as we have this this social construct of race. So long as we are defining people by race, there will be racism. So long as we rely on the subconscious and what keeps feeling safe about who we are and the differences of other people, we will always have race as a cornerstone of this country and one of the most critical issues facing progress and justice and everything else you can imagine going forward.
Sakara Remu, thank you so much for sharing those thoughts with us. Very thought-provoking for me, and hope to continue these conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Sakara Remu is a writer, activist, and a mother of two young teenagers. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:16. We're going to talk with Seattle mayoral candidate Kate Martin in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. It's going to be a hot, sunny day. Currently 74 degrees, blue sky, lots of sun. Forecast says we're going to get up to 88 this afternoon.
It's going to be cloudy overnight, chance of thunderstorms, low of 62, and tomorrow, Wednesday, some clouds in the morning, then mostly sunny again with a high of 81. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Some thoughts on why we love the bad guy in 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Election Day is August 6th. Ballots go out in the mail this week. 9 people are vying to be Seattle's next mayor. This week on Weekday in the Conversation, we're talking with all 9 candidates. Those conversations will be archived at our website, kuow.org. Search for elections. Kate Martin's lived in Seattle since 1979. She owns a planning and design business. She has a long history of civic involvement, including a recent campaign for Seattle School Board. Martin's been active in planning issues for her Greenwood neighborhood, as well as citywide involvement with everything from open space to skate parks to pedestrian issues. We're asking candidates a series of similar questions, and Kate Martin, we're happy to have you here to answer them.
Thank you, Marcy.
First, why did you decide to enter the race for Seattle mayor?
You know, in all the years I've been paying attention, I've always thought that the policy direction that the city goes in general is not productive. I think feel-good policies or attempts to solve things isn't good enough for me. So I'm looking to just change the policy direction to successful policies.
So given that successful policies, what would be the priority issue that you would address if elected coming in?
Well, I think my policy priority is the police department, and it needs to go well beyond what the Department of Justice is suggesting. So I have some ideas on how we could actually restructure.
Would you like to elaborate on this?
Yeah. So there's some interesting issues, and this is prevalent across the board with the 11,000 employees that the city has, and that is we're not developing the human resources that we have. And this is illustrated at the police department. We just do not have the development of the officers or the management of the officers occurring.
So you're talking about the city actually implementing more detailed training, better training?
Correct. I think in the private sector as well as the public sector, there's been a lack of development of human resources. I think the plug-and-play mentality is just not panning out very well.
This is then, I take it, I was going to ask you to elaborate. On your website, you say rebuild the Seattle Police Department. That's the top on the list of priorities. How would you approach the top level, the chief himself or herself?
Yes, that's a good question. We need a real chief, that's for sure. But I think that some of the keys to really restructuring the police department has to do more at the sergeant level. I think a sergeant is really in charge of a handful of people. It's really, that's where we can probably make the biggest difference. And I think we have to seek a more educated command staff. Basically, a GED gets you into the police force, and just a test gets you into management. So I've seen other police forces that require college degrees, and I think something like international relations, peace and social justice, those kind of educations would really help us build a more effective police force.
We have heard a lot about transportation issues in the city of Seattle. You have worked on these as well. What would be your first act, or at least your first set of actions when it comes to transportation planning in the city?
Yeah, so I don't think we have done a very good job of comprehensive planning of transportation. I think we seem to be afraid to have the difficult conversation that needs to happen with single-occupant vehicle drivers. My first action, I'm a person from a planning perspective, so I look at a cost-benefit analysis of solutions. I think we have to look at free and cheap solutions first. So for me, I need to keep the buses moving. I ride the bus. It took me an hour and 10 minutes to get from Ballard to downtown on the rapid ride the other day. I think we have to free up real estate in the right-of-way to keep the buses moving.
You have been long involved in your neighborhood and neighborhood planning issues, and I'm curious where you see the intersection between transportation planning and neighborhood planning, zoning issues.
Yeah, it's interesting. The city has taken a policy direction that I'm not terribly in agreement with in terms of transit and development. They have a new direction than they've actually incorporated into the comprehensive plan called transit communities. But it concentrates a lot of residences on very polluted arterials, which I disagree with. It also does not provide a diversity of housing options. So obviously, I don't think it's healthy to have everybody concentrated on polluted arterials. But I also think that lots of people, especially people with children, really shouldn't be out on those arterials. They need to be someplace where there's space and neighborhood building available.
What role do you think that the community councils themselves should have? I guess how great a weight should be placed on decisions that come out of the community councils when it comes to zoning changes that are made at the city level?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that the city does pay a little bit of lip service to community councils. If you happen to be very well organized, you might be able to get something. That's a new direction I'm going to take with the city, because when I was really active at the Greenwood Community Council, and that was actually when Mike was president, you know, he didn't...
Mike McGinn.
Yeah, Mike McGinn. He didn't... We needed to rezone our town center to get our auto-oriented zoning out of there, and he just wouldn't fight for it. We got it done when he was gone. We really needed to get a critical area for the sinking peat problem in our neighborhood. He couldn't get it done, but we got it done when he got out of there. You can get things done with the community council. You need to be very, very proactive, and you need to be very disciplined about your priorities.
So if you were sitting in his seat in City Hall as opposed to being active on the community council, how do you incorporate the sort of disparate amounts of involvement across the city? I mean, how do you encourage more involvement where there hasn't been, and how do you take the feedback and the plans that community members have spent a lot of hours putting together and incorporate them into your policy as mayor?
Yeah, so I served on the Neighborhood Plan Update Committee, and as a planner, I have to say that our neighborhood plans are not really planning. They're more demographics of how many people we can cram into the neighborhoods, but there's not a concurrency of the other things that neighborhoods need to actually be healthy, successful neighborhoods. So I'm going to change the direction of how we do neighborhood planning so that we can see clearly what the gaps are in each neighborhood, what they need to get, and put a timeline on it. Additionally, throwing neighborhoods crumbs like the street fund. Here's every district gets one block of sidewalks per district per year. Well, that's the 400-year plan. I actually have a comprehensive plan to finish the sidewalk system, because that's, again, my planning coming to the fore. How can we systemically solve the problems?
Your plan for sidewalks, just for example, involves, I guess, what I would call a public-private partnership, right? You want to explain a little bit how you think it might work?
Yeah, and so all old ideas kind of becoming new again, because the sidewalks in Seattle were paid for by the landowners. There's a big myth out there about how they were promised when we annexed these areas of city. But I did research with the people that were actually involved with it at the time, and that's just kind of an urban myth that goes along. The fact is, people paid for their own sidewalks. It was rolled into their taxes. And my idea is to kind of return to that, but a little creatively. I'd like the city to handle the intersections and then have the landowners connect the dots between the intersections. And I think together, with that kind of leverage, we can have more a 20-year plan instead of a 400-year plan for sidewalks.
Moving from neighborhoods to downtown, you have a very specific vision for what we could do at the downtown waterfront. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I really want to prioritize downtown, the central waterfront, and what happens. I've been following the central waterfront planning, and I feel that we basically are creating a glorified tourist trap down on the surface, and we're not really giving Seattle the waterfront for all that was promised. The University of Washington has taken a look at reusing the viaduct for open space, and I grabbed onto that when we did our open space visioning 2100 a few years back. I think if we save the upper deck of the viaduct, seismically retrofit it, and make ourselves the world's finest elevated park from Pike Market to Pioneer Square, that's going to turn the key on a lot of downtown. That's the kind of bold gesture that can really change the downtown environment. And really, the idea of being able to stroll out onto that viaduct and really access that view resource, that's the kind of thing we really need to be doing.
Recently, the mayor and city council announced that they were going to shut down the homeless camp called Nicholsville and for good and try to find housing for the residents. Was that the right decision?
I think that is the right decision. I think there's a lot of things at play with Nicholsville. I think one little piece of it is kind of the political protest trying to illustrate homelessness. And I really don't want it illustrated in this kind of way. I think that trespassing on property that doesn't belong to you is always going to be wrong. So as mayor, I really need to enforce the laws that we have. And I don't think that building monocultures of homelessness is healthy or productive. I really think that small groups of homeless can be helped. But when it just becomes a big, let's throw all the homeless together in tents through rainy, windy winters in Seattle, it's just not making sense for me.
You ran a very vigorous campaign for school board in 2011, and I know school issues are important to you. How do you imagine as mayor that you could focus attention on public education?
Yeah, so I think I'm the only candidate that really actually understands Seattle Public Schools. I mean, I've got the issues, the neighborhoods, the city, but I've also got that Seattle Public Schools piece. And I think the mistake that we're making with how we're attempting to complement the school district is we're repeating the very same mistakes the school district is making in their programs and policies. So I would like to actually see us go in a direction of productive changes that are actually going to be at the front end, proactive, and not this kind of what I call feeding trough for the failure industry, which is kind of what the Families and Education Levy has become.
So at this point in time, there are legalities that separate the district, the school district, from the city. How do you imagine breaking that down so that as mayor, you could play a more active and effective role in the schools?
Yeah, so it'll kind of be twofold. I will be stepping on toes at the school district because I think there's a lot of toes that need to be stepped on. And I like to say, I would love to take over the schools, but let me fix the police department first, and then let's move on to things that I'm not already in charge of.
So the first thing that you would do if elected would be to start on public safety?
Yes. I mean, there's going to be about five initiatives that I jump in with right away, and I just believe that the public safety is the government's main role, and so let's get that one right. But again, I would love to take over the schools, but let me get the other things in line first.
That would be 4 years. You could start one at a time.
Right.
Some of our observers have said that the nine candidates for mayor or the eight who have been actively campaigning share a lot of progressive values. How do you distinguish yourself from those other candidates?
Yeah, so I'm the fiscally responsible liberal, basically. I think I describe it as just what the doctor ordered, because I just don't think we can go down this road of irresponsibility any longer. I mean, I take a look at the budget at the city of Seattle, and I can see so many structural flaws that are just being perpetuated. The ridiculous overtime at fire and police. Mike only put $2 million citywide into street repair from the general fund. $2 million. That's missing a few zeros on it. So I'd like to take a look at really grabbing the budget in a very fiscally responsible way.
How does your small business experience, because you are a business owner, you've had a lot of experience, how do you translate that on a level where you're totally in charge to being in a bureaucracy, is the only word I can think of, with thousands of people and a lot of folks who have their fiefdoms?
Yeah, it's really easy to say, oh, it's a big bureaucracy. Oh, how are we going to affect change? It's a big bureaucracy. But that's not really how I think. I think business skills, solid business skills, scale up, no problem. So what we're really lacking in leadership is solid business skills. The size of the organization is not the issue. It's whether or not you have the business skills.
So you've talked about business skills, your background as a planner, your long years of civic engagement. But what do you think overall, all those strengths, what is the one that you think is most important and that most qualifies you to be mayor of Seattle?
Yeah, so the job of the mayor is the day-to-day operations of these huge departments, but it's also the vision. So in my opinion, coming to the table as a planner and designer, I'm not afraid to create bold gestures in a vision. And I think that's seriously been lacking in Seattle.
Kate Martin's running for mayor of Seattle, and we'll have this conversation along with all eight that we of the other mayoral candidates archived on our website. This evening, we'll also be simulcasting a live mayoral debate that's going to be broadcast on KCTS 9. And I'm sure that you're going to be there as well. I really appreciate you taking time to come in and talk with us.
Thank you so much, Marcy.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
Nine 31. author Chuck Klosterman on our fascination with villains in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 75 degrees at the moment, expecting to get up to 88 this afternoon with lots of sun.
The Queen of Dolls, Barbie, is losing sales to some new rivals, the Vampires and Ghouls of Monster High.
She's our werewolf, so she's going to howl for us. She tosses her head back, she arches her back, she closes her eyes, and she is literally howling at the moon.
I'm Renee Montaigne, Dolls Go Goth, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m. And just a quick correction, the simulcast of KCTS9 mayoral primary debate will be Thursday night at 7 o'clock. Not tonight, but Thursday night at 7 o'clock, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, connecting with the community all summer long through PCC Healthy Kids and the Kids Picks Mobile, introducing kids to healthful foods at neighborhood events. 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com/events.
It is going to be hot and sunny today. We'll get a more in-depth weather forecast and a hike to match that weather forecast in about 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. If you ever talk with actors, they'll tell you they much prefer to play the villain than a straight-ahead hero or heroine. The inherent allure of a villain is sort of at the heart of Chuck Klosterman's new book, I Wear the Black Hat. It's a collection of essays about who's good, who's not, and what attracts us to the bad girl or the bad guy. Chuck Klosterman, thanks for joining me.
Hey, it's good to be here.
When did you realize that Darth Vader was more interesting than Luke Skywalker?
Well, you know, I don't know if I ever consciously came to that decision until I started writing this book, but I was having a conversation with my editor probably, I don't know, 3 years ago when I was just on the very early stages of doing a book of essays that had sort of a nebulous theme, but I knew it was going to involve villainy. And one of the things that happened is he had a 4-year-old son who had just watched Star Wars. So we were talking about Star Wars over lunch. And I said, you know, it occurs to me that there's this arc that male Star Wars fans seem to go through, which is that, you know, when they're 7 or 8 and they watch Star Wars, the person that they love or relate to or identify with is Luke Skywalker, who's this purely good character, almost naively good, has a very inflexible view of what's right and what's wrong. And then they become a teenager, you know, and it shifts to Han Solo, who is fundamentally good, but has the trappings of a villain almost. He seems problematic and anti-authoritarian.
He's a smuggler.
Yes, you know, he is technically a criminal. Yet we know from watching the film that, you know, at his core, he is still heroic. But he seems to be kind of this mixed personality, and that becomes attractive. But once you become an adult and you're no longer aspiring to something, when you're looking at a character and trying to identify with it or maybe see yourself within that with that person, suddenly it seems like Darth Vader is the character you relate to the most and is maybe the only essential character in the story. And that has to do sort of with my theme with this book, the idea that as you mature, the way you view characters, both fictional and non-fictional, shifts. Yeah.
But there are bad guys, and then, as they say, there are bad guys. And not every bad guy ultimately might be seen in a better light. For example, some serial killers are never redeemed.
Well, I mean, I only really write about serial killers in this book. I have in other books, but not so much in this one. I do reference Ted Bundy a little bit, but for kind of a strange reason. The fact of the matter is, serial killers are almost subhuman. To be a villain, there has to be an element of humanity in that person. It can't be, you know, a caricature of evil for the most part. You know, and I'm more interested in the people who are almost consciously complex and in a mediated culture are viewed negatively. But I think from a sort of a curiosity standpoint, there's something attractive about the negative identity. It does seem, I think, more authentic to people in many ways, which is why villains are often more interesting than heroes.
Well, I'm interested in the notion of that archetypal sympathetic bad guy. And as I was reading, before I actually got to the part where you mention it, who came to my mind was Professor Harold Hill in The Music Man.
Well, that's the idea of a kind of a con man, right? The confidence man, mm-hmm. who in literature and in film and in television shows are typically displayed with a positive connotation. A con man is very interesting in most fictional settings. Although if you ever meet someone who's actually been conned for real, you sort of see how kind of perverse that attraction is. But it's kind of understandable too.
Well, you actually did meet someone who'd been involved with a con man, or you know somebody who had that experience.
Yeah, I worked at Spin Magazine. There was someone in the office I worked with, and he eventually left the magazine, and we were having drinks later, and I was in the process of researching this book, and I had read the book The Big Con, which is a very sympathetic kind of take on confidence man written from the point of view of a con artist. And I'm talking to my friend about this, and he has this kind of curious, strange look on his face, and then he goes like, well, okay, here's the deal. My dad was a con man. He posed as clergyman and ripped off elderly women in the congregation, then left his family and stole the Social Security information of both his sons, pretty much ruined his kid's life. He was in debt for 15 years. So he was sort of like, I'm not fascinated by con men.
But then I think about sort of the pretty con men, the movie The Sting with, mm-hmm. you know, when was that, the 70s? The, you know,
yes.
Two blonde, you know, Newman and Redford, handsome con, you know, they're handsome. They're pretty.
Well, yeah. Well, and, you know, the timing of that movie is meaningful. In the 70s, when the auteur movement kind of became the dominant form of filmmaking in America, and directors had, you know, a kind of a singular vision, we saw the rise of that kind of, you know, quote-unquote anti-hero in a lot of films, in The Godfather and The Sting and a lot of Jack Nicholson's films from that period. Then it happened again in television in the 90s, first with The Sopranos and then with Breaking Bad and The Wire and Mad Men and these shows. So part of the rise of the interest in villainy can really be seen over time, you know, first in literature, then in film and rock music, and then finally in television. And it's the kind of continual movement toward realism in art. That's one of the sort of uncomfortable things about the idea of the villain. For whatever reason, it is taken as more realistic than a hero by the audience.
We're talking with Chuck Klosterman, and his new book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. And perhaps it just is from where you're writing from, or maybe where I'm reading from, but there are a preponderance of male villains with just a couple of bad girls thrown in. So are there more bad guys than bad girls?
Well, look, this book is not comprehensive. Like, it is not. It's not an encyclopedia of villains, which I think some people sort of assume going into it. You know, I just write what's interesting to me at the time I'm working, and I don't. You know, maybe to my detriment to a degree, I don't factor in gender and race and class as much as maybe a sociologist would, but. It's just always been interesting. You know, this is my eighth book now, and my early books, the first one was about like glam metal growing up in the Midwest and listening to Kiss and Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses. And my second book was Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and that was about kind of low culture. You know, Pamela Anderson's in there, like Saved by the Bell. Mm-hmm. I write those books, and I kind of feel like they're chock full of ideas. And then when I was interviewed about them, of course, people just wanted to ask me questions about the band Queensryche. Or they wanted to ask me about how do you really feel about John Cusack and all this stuff. And I was disappointed because I was like, oh, I have all these ideas about culture and everyone's just entered like the tangible content. Well, now I'm kind of on the other end. I still view this book as essentially entertainment, like a kind of intellectual entertainment, a way to read about people like Hitler and D.B. Cooper and O.J. Simpson in a way that's sort of fun and engaging. But of course, because the individuals themselves are more serious, the questions are all like, you know, like, what do you think of Pol Pot? Like, how do we deal with Stalin? You know, and that those people are in the book. I don't mind those questions. I guess I'm just kind of a malcontent. I'm always unhappy with what people are interested in my own work.
Well, I was actually thinking of Lindsay Lohan. I wasn't even going there. I was there with you in the pop culture.
You know, she is one person who I almost wrote about and didn't. There were a couple key figures, Lindsay Lohan being one, Kanye West being one, LeBron James being another, that I had essays sort of in my mind kind of worked up to do, but they're still changing. We're still seeing these characters sort of evolve in real time. The difference between, you know, doing journalism and writing a nonfiction book is, in theory, this nonfiction book should be able to be read in 10 years or 25 years or 60 years. So you really have to feel like the idea you're talking about is galvanized and static. So someone like Lindsay Lohan, who is, you know, a really sort of intriguing character in the modern landscape, quite honest, I had a fear she might die in the time that I was writing this book, and then anything I would have said about her would suddenly have a real charged connotation. So I was like, I'm going to wait for people. You know, I write about people who are in the present tense but a little bit distant. I almost like really short-term history.
Yeah. But you also talk a lot, which really fascinates me, about who can evolve from being reviled on maybe a pop culture level, and maybe in the case of Hitler, on a wider level.
I don't talk about Hitler's evolution that much. That
is not
in the book.
No. In fact, I feel like he was just an obligatory addition to your book. But people, for example, you write about NWA and Public Enemy, mm-hmm. and O.J. Simpson, another character. There are some people who, over a course of time, we might hate them, and then with 10 years of hindsight, we think, there's some redeeming features. I might argue that I don't feel that way about O.J. Simpson.
I don't know if I do either. I think that he presents a specifically complex problem. But for the most part, in all of these pieces, this really is just as another essay collection. They just, the theme is kind of the through thread. But, you know, we're never really dealing with the celebrities we think we're dealing with, or the fictional characters we think we're dealing with. We're dealing with the mediated version of those people. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, when we talk about the evolution of people, or how someone was, you know, beloved and then despised and then, you know, had a comeback, what we're really talking about is the machinations of how people are covered. For the most part, people do, you know, they commit the acts they do with the motives that are usually nebulous or unclear, and everybody else around decides what the context is. I'm really kind of interested in the idea of the context not being created by the artist, but by the audience.
So you have this other hat. I mean, you have your popular culture hat. That's what you do for most of your job. But you also write this ethicist column for the New York Times. And as I was reading this, I couldn't help but think about situational ethics and, you know, how the needle's not necessarily firm and fast. And so I wonder, you know, what you take from writing a book like this back to that sort of loftier New York Times work.
Well, okay, first of all, I love doing the ethicist. I still see it as primarily a newspaper column. Like, I in no way frame myself as the most ethical person in New York. You know, people ask me questions and I respond to them from a detached sort of, I'd like to believe, rational perspective. Okay, like, you know, I don't have a horse in the race. Somebody says I have this problem. I'm not sure how I would react necessarily if I was in that person's shoes. But being outside of it, I can say, well, this would be an ethical way to handle it. As it applies to, like, you know, this book, and I mean, your reference to situational ethics is very interesting, because certainly there are some people who are, like, really into Immanuel Kant, and they're like, things are ethical or they're not. Mm-hmm. There's no shades of gray. And I really feel like I live in a gray world where everything is based around trying to deduce where something falls into a continuum and then saying, okay, what is the consequence here? What is the real damage? What is the motive? What was the intent? If somebody were to, you know, come to the reading tonight and say, like, you know, you're a situational ethicist, I would be like, well, I guess I am. You know, I mean, it would seem to me, if we remove the idea of context and the situation, then every question the ethicist would just end with me saying yes or no. Like, that's ethical. No, it's not. You know, that would be it. That's not how it works for me. To me, it's the idea of working through these problems. I don't expect people to take my advice literally, you know.
When did you decide that you thought you actually wore the black hat?
I guess I thought that my whole life, in a way. I mean, I'm also raised Catholic, and that sort of forces someone to kind of think that they are a sinful, problematic person. But I've always been wary of my own motives. Even, you know, even when my behavior was good, when I would do good things, I would wonder, what was my motive for doing this? Would I have done this in a vacuum if no one knew I was doing it? Over time, you know, I life has become more complex. I mean, I'm sure everybody, like I'm 41, I'm sure everybody who's listening to this who's in their 40s will agree with the following statement. The world made much more sense to me when I was 21. Mm-hmm. You know, and though I didn't know what I would be doing in 20 years, I guess I assumed I would have more clarity about reality. I did not think it would be more complex and less clear. I now assume that when I'm 61, life will even seem more insane. So I have a pretty bleak outlook on the idea of really understanding my life. It just seems like it's never going to happen.
Well, the thing I think the page that I folded down because it was sort of the most relevant to me was the chapter about parental stuff and the future and your wired in kids, and I have a very wired in teenager, and you know, I think, you know, what does this mean about human interaction? And you actually had quite an optimistic statement in there, which is that the future is always changing, and so you know, you kind
well,
of
well, yeah, that's a given. The future, I mean, but yeah. The statement is sort of like, you know, the progressives always end up winning. Now, when you say that statement, it does sound really positive. It's like, oh, people with progressive ideas, you know, are going to win out in the end. But it almost doesn't even matter the value of those ideas. It's especially with technology. I mean, the thing you're referencing from the book, you know, I think that when people were growing up in the 60s and 70s, their parents were worried about them. And they would be worried, oh, my kid's into Black Sabbath, or I don't know if I want my kid to see the movie Porky's or whatever, because I don't want them to see these images. But now that has shifted. Modern parents are in a different position. They grew up with rock music, and they grew up seeing rated R movies probably earlier than they would have in a previous generation. And they've come to this conclusion that, you know, the actual content isn't the problem. It's the device they're getting it on. You know, you see a four-year-old kid just enraptured with an iPad, you know, for hours at a time. Like, I have friends who have children who they can't listen to a complete sentence from a human without losing, you know, without looking away or walking away. But if you give them, like, a phone, they'll stare at the phone forever. And everybody sort of senses there's something uncomfortable about this, that they're living in this false reality. And then it's like, but that false reality is the future. Computers matter more now than they did 10 years ago. They're going to matter exponentially more 10 years from now. So you can't stop the kid from having that experience. It's almost – it's like not letting them learn how to drive or something, or like not teaching them how to boil water. But it does feel uncomfortable because it's as if you're losing sort of the relationship to humanity that we'd like to believe is intrinsic.
I'm listening to you and thinking, you told me a few minutes ago that, you know, your books have become increasingly more popular, less about the big idea, and you've just laid out an incredibly big idea. So you're kind of fibbing, aren't you?
About what?
about not being about the big idea. You are about the
big
idea.
Well, no, what I was really arguing is that I feel like I've always sort of dealt with these kind of ideas. It's just I'm surprised by how people are more – I shouldn't even be surprised by this. I guess I notice that people are much more impacted by the examples you used as opposed to the idea. In other words, talking about the idea I just talked about that seems like a big idea when I'm talking about technology, if I was really specifically talking about – oh, the iPad, and it was all about the iPad, people would look at the idea differently. They think that, oh, he's actually talking about a product. You know, mm-hmm. As I've moved away from talking about things that are clearly products like bands and television shows, this idea becomes, well, oh, you're a philosopher now, but I'm kind of the same person. I've just had the normal sort of maturation of any, I'd like to think, semi-smart person from the age of 27 or whatever to 41, which is the scope of my writing, basically.
Look forward to the one when you write when you're 61. Who knows what great ideas you'll be touching on. Well, thanks for talking to me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Chuck Klosterman covers pop culture and sports for ESPN. He's the ethicist for the New York Times, and his new book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. He'll be at Elliott Bay Books on Capitol Hill tonight at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. It is Tuesday, and it has been incredibly beautiful, so it's a good time to check in with Michael Fagan for a look at the weather and a look at a hike we can take. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Marcy.
It has been what I call perfect, but that's not going to quite hold for the next couple of days.
That's right. So far, we have 18 straight days of no rain, and we have a ways to go to beat the record from last year where we had 47 days. So anyhow, we do have an area low pressure to our south. It'll bring in some clouds basically this afternoon, but more likely late tonight and into Wednesday. And with that, we're looking at a chance of some thunder showers, mainly for the mountains, but some of the rain might drift into the lowlands, like I said, late tonight, but more likely on Wednesday. Highs today will be in the upper 80s, and it'll start to get a little humid, so a little bit uncomfortable as far as that goes. Then Wednesday, highs about 80, then Thursday through the weekend, highs 80 degrees and plenty of afternoon sun. Now, our hike, we're actually going to give you a couple suggestions, and they're right next to each other. Kelly Butte, which is off of Highway 410 near the town of Greenwater. And one of the reasons to go in the next week or so, the wildflowers are just out galore. There's thousands and thousands of bare grass flowers, and you'll see on the blog all the wonderful flowers we have. And this is a shorter hike. It's only 3.4 miles round trip. It's short, but it is steep, so about a 900-foot gain. Best to do the hike if you can get off of work in short order and head over there before the thunderstorms happen tonight. That'd be a good option. Wednesday would not do that with the thunderstorms. It'd really be best to do this Thursday through the weekend.
Michael, where is Greenwater? I'm not sure I know where that is.
Well, that's a good question. It's because a lot of people don't know where it is. It's on the way to Crystal Mountain.
Oh.
That area.
So it's pretty high elevation.
Yeah, so we'll be, town of Greenwater itself is not high, but it is on the way to Crystal Mountain near Enumclaw, and the hike is about at 5,000 feet.
Mm.
And so it would be best, really, to do that Thursday through the weekend, because the views will be great, the weather will be stable, you'll get views of Mount Rainier. And if you're looking for a hike today, we do also have listed right next to it, along in the same region, Palisades, a hike which is in the forest, which would be good on a hot day today with the waterfalls. So you have two options. And getting back to Kelly Butte, if you do go up there, they have a restored lookout. You can go inside and look at the wonderful views. And for this hike, as well as for the Palisades hike, you'll need the trail pass and Green Trails Map 238 and 239. And with the warmer weather, you want to make sure you stop for some ice cream after your hike. I think that was our highlight when we went.
The ice cream?
Yeah. Well, the views were pretty nice, too. So the views were our first priority, and the second one was the ice cream.
Now, Michael, you mentioned that it's been 18 straight days with no rain, and last year the record was 47 days. I think it was last year's record, right?
Right.
But you also have listed for me another streak, and I'm wondering if you want to take a bet which one. First of all, tell us about the other streak.
Well, the other streak, being a baseball fan, I'll have to keep track of the Mariners. They haven't had a lot to gloat about lately, but they've hit at least one home run in 22 straight games, and the major league record's 27. So it looks like maybe the Mariners have a better chance of breaking the streak as opposed to the rainless streak. So I'm betting on the Mariners over the rain. How's that?
That's good. You can add another streak because I think Raul Ibanez is about to break Ted Williams' RBI record for people over the age of 40. It's kind of obscure, but, you know, you've got to always cheer for folks.
That's right. You did your homework. That's good. Yeah, Raul's, I think he's got that home run. I think he has like 24 home runs and needs to reach 29.
Yep. So, and he's got some time to do it.
Yeah, so we have all sorts of records. Let's keep our fingers crossed with the rain. We might get a drop or two of rain, but best chance will be for the mountains. And again, we have the lower elevation hike, the Palisades hike in the forest would probably be best today, given the chance of thunderstorms, and Kelly Butte will be perfect for Thursday through the weekend. So,
essentially, today is the hot and humid day, and then it's going to be more seasonal as soon as that front goes through?
Right, right. So the weather will be unstable later today, most likely this evening and Wednesday, and then Thursday through Sunday, the ridge of high pressure rebuilds for the return of weather that we all love.
Thanks so much. Michael Fagan is the host of the West Coast Weather LLC. His blog is called Fagan's Weather World, and he's got great pictures of this week's hike and past hikes. You can find him at hikewashington.net. Michael, talk to you next week.
Sounds great.
And now, the sound of the day. That's the song of Kedrin, as sent to us by her mom, Anne. Pretty good singing. Anne says for the last couple of months, Kedrin's been singing variations of this song to her cats, to her monkey, I'm assuming it's a stuffed monkey, to her feet and to anyone else.
Her feet.
Her feet.
Her feet are music fans.
Yeah, well, you know how babies are so flexible,
yeah.
Their feet come all the way up to their mouths. Anne calls this a song because it reminds her of an LP called The Song of the Humpback Whale that Anne's mother played for Anne when she was a very little girl. So this would be the song of the non-humpback baby, I guess. It's pretty good. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds of what you hear and send that sound to us. Along with the story behind the sound, you can email your audio file to weekday at kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. We got a file that said sound du jour. You can say that as well, or whatever other language you want to use. Bernard, coming up, we're going to talk to Seattle mayoral candidate Doug McQuaid. He's been pretty elusive on the campaign trail, but we did catch up.
Track them down, huh?
Yep, and our Green Days gardeners are going to be in as well, so stay with us.
That's all ahead just a few minutes from now, right after this hour's newscast, which is coming up. There's been no sign of a missing 79-year-old mushroom hunter here in Washington, and now her colleagues are planning a memorial service for her. More about that in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
When Jimmy Wales started Wikipedia, it was manageable.
In the early days, I used to read every single edit.
Wow.
As they came in, I would click and see what someone had done.
Someone in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Edited. Spanish language. Someone edited. United Kingdom. Edited. Of Monsters and Men.
That someone only lasted for a very short period of time. It got very fast. It was impossible to keep up with everything.
Channeling chaos into collaboration. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And you can hear that tonight at 8 o'clock, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the merchants at SeaTac Airport, including Polino Pasteria in the Central Terminal, featuring freshly made pizzas, pastas, and Italian-inspired sandwiches for travel. Information on SeaTac Merchants Mileage Plan participation at SeaTacShops.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.